I need to know everything. Who and the what and the where, I need everything. Trust me, I hear what you're saying, but act like it's new what you're telling me. I'm curious, George, I hop in the Porsche, it's 500 horse, I'm ready for war, I'm coming for throats, to turn to a ghost, I need to know everything. Now you'll be surprised at the info you get is by letting them talk.
Hey everyone, I'm Ashley Asti, and I'm curious, aren't you? I'm Curious podcast brings the unfamiliar closer. I'm telling stories and sharing conversations with people who remind us that love demands we move toward justice and that we're all connected. This opening music is called Curious George by Nate Rose. All right, let's get to it.
I'm ready for smoke. I need to know everything. Who and the what and the where, I need everything. Trust me, I hear what you're saying, but act like it's new what you're telling me. I'm curious, George, I hop in the Porsche, it's 500 horse, I'm ready for war, I'm coming for throats, to turn to a ghost, I need to know everything. Now they ain't go harder than me.
Oh, it is good to be back. In this conversation with Jim Elsesser, we had this moment where we were talking about how poetry first came to him, when he noticed it. And he talks about being a kid and reading this poem and realizing, he says, I knew I wanted more. And I feel like that was the essence of this conversation with Jim. I love the pauses that he takes, the way it makes me sort of lean in and want to listen a little bit more closely to what he's saying. This is a full-ranging conversation about the sacred and healing power of poetry, but not just poetry, of community, of storytelling, of seeing each other and letting ourselves, our inner expression, be seen and heard. We dive into the way poetry lives in the body, the poetry experience that changed his life, to the way writing poetry is about listening to what our soul is trying to tell us, how poetry is for anyone. You don't have to be a writer, a poet. You don't have to worry about grammar. You don't have to judge or think. Everyone has a soul that yearns to express itself. And we talk about how poetry is a connection to awe. So a little about Jim. Jim and I met through the Institute for Poetic Medicine, which he talks about in the episode. He has served for years, both formally and informally, as a poetry facilitator. Specifically, he works now at the Domestic Abuse and Sexual Assault Intervention Services, DAISY, in Newton, New Jersey, where he leads Rise Up Poetry Project, which are healing poetry workshops for survivors of domestic and sexual violence. He's also a peer recovery specialist at Decide, a program that works with men who have used violence in their relationships. One of the things we discuss in this conversation is that he's also facilitated poetry workshops with the School of Leadership Afghanistan, or SOLA. These workshops have been on hiatus for a couple years because of the pandemic and the Taliban coming in and banning education for girls in Afghanistan. But the school has relocated to Rwanda and he's about to start up again. His poems have appeared in numerous outlets, including the Stillwater Review, Two River View, Seeds, Where Beach Meets Ocean, and the Patterson Literary Review. Jim is the father of two girls, Jessica and Lindsay, and he lives in Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania with his cats, Scout and Tom. For me, this conversation was nourishing and beautiful. It was what my spirit was looking for, and I hope it serves your spirit too. So let's dive in. So I want to start with a question about love. I want to know, when did you first fall for poetry? When did you first notice it speaking to you?
That is a great question and a wonderful place to start. That's kind of what I had in mind. So I appreciate it. I attended a conference in 2015, not far from here. I walked into the room late. There were like 100 people in the room. And as I walked in from the back, the speaker, who happened to be a guy named John Fox, who will play a part in this story later on, asked the question, when did poetry first come to you? And I don't think I'd ever heard that question phrased like that. Or like, when did you first get into poetry? No, when did poetry first come to you? And it's like, oh. And I had this image in my head of being like in fourth grade and seeing a textbook open in front of me. I went to this very rural three-room school and, you know, wasn't highly accessible to the arts. But anyway, I'm sitting in front of this textbook, and on the left is a poem. Might have been Robert Frost, I don't remember. And on the right is a photograph of some birch trees in a woods, and there's like a fog. And I remember reading that poem, specifically thinking, like, what is this? And I didn't know what it was, but it was deep and it was mysterious. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted more. I knew I wanted more at that moment. And it has been a long, circuitous route to really embrace poetry and live with poetry. But that I really think was the first moment of love, or that spark in the eyes of, okay, this is wonderful.
Yeah, I love how he phrased that. When did it come to you? Because it is a thing that it's sort of like it arrives. It can't be forced. But you mentioned that it was sort of a long journey to live with poetry. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I grew up, I went to high school. I was not an academically cogent person. I didn't do well in school. I was just checked out. But I did have one English teacher who I just adored, because he was so calm. And we talk about The Catcher in the Rye, or read things like that, and have these questions about life and what it means to be a person. And we read poetry there. And I just remember reading different poets and thinking, this is wonderful. I really like this. Got out of high school. I worked for an electrician for a year. Okay, I got to do more than this. I wound up in Colorado going to a junior college for natural resource management. I was going to be a park ranger. And that lasted about 6 weeks. And I took an English class, a literature class, and I was like, this is fantastic. I just love this. So, okay, I'm going to be an English teacher. So I got a degree in English secondary education. I taught for a couple years. And I think poetry for me, I was just like obsessed with the academic piece of it, like digging into meaning and reading these poems of like depth and metaphor and these allusions that I had to follow these threads, these little breadcrumbs to some kind of truth, what it means to be a human being. So it's like totally in my head. So I'm in college and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to go out in high school. I'm going to be the cool teacher. I'm going to pour out my wisdom to these kids. And it didn't work. So long story short, you know, I got married, had kids, a house, and I went back to being an electrician for many years. And then about 30 years ago, my wife and I joined a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And all the poems that had been in the attic and boxes came down, and I found there was this community that revered art and poetry and dance and song and creativity. And we had a writer's group. I attended that for years, and actually came to lead that. I started going to conferences, like at Block Island and different places, and the Dodge Poetry Festival, which was like the largest poetry festival in North America. It was just fantastic. And that just kind of blew me open. Like, this is what I want. I knew it was a part of my life, you know.
I love the phrase blew me open, because it's just, I mean, it's just the image of it blowing you open. And you know, you lead now, well, because you said before that when you first were approaching poetry, maybe right around the time you're teaching, it was kind of in your head, a place of metaphor and allusion and all of those things. And I think so often when poetry is taught, it gets lost in academic spaces there in the head. And it needs to like drop down into the body and into the heart. And now you lead healing poetry workshops. So what is a healing poetry workshop, or what is healing poetry?
Well, I think it's, you know, poetry is a way of storytelling. And I guess I can drop down into the body and the heart by telling a story about one poem that changed my life. And that was a situation in 8 years ago, where I led a lay-led service at our Unitarian Fellowship. And I did a whole piece on poetry. So I had some fun with that and talk about what poetry was, what it wasn't. And I led a little writing prompt. It was kind of a Mad Lib. And the Mad Lib went like, so it was like, think of a family member and then fill in the blank. I remember my blank told me blank, we were blank and blank, It felt like blank. Sometimes I think blank, but now I realize blank. So people were writing and writing and writing. And it's like, hey, guys, you know, we're writing a novelette here. So folks read their stuff. And this diminutive gentleman named Dave Wilner, 92 years old, stood up and said, a friend once told me, time moves on for every man, but for you it stands still. The bombs and bullets still fly, and you forever die. And he sat down, and there was this pause in the room. And I was struck by that. And he was writing about being at Normandy in World War II, 72 years previous to that moment. And it's the idea, this guy didn't walk into that room like, okay, I'm going to write about being in Normandy on that emotional level. Like, you forever die is, you know, that's kind of speaks to his experience following that. So Dave told me a few weeks later, he woke up for the next 3 weeks and he dreamed a poem and he wrote each one down. And I was just struck by that. So a little while after that, I was at a picnic and I met a person who told me she worked at this place called DAISY, Domestic Abuse and Sexual Assault Intervention Services in Newton, New Jersey. And they serve survivors of domestic violence, sexual violence, and human trafficking. And told me something about her work. Never met this person before. And I told this story about this guy in the poem and him dreaming them. And she goes, wow, we have these writing workshops. Would you like to lead a poetry workshop? And I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. You know, so I'm driving home and I'm thinking, what did I just get myself into? I mean, it was really intimidating in the sense that recognizing that I'd be working with people in crisis and the potential for triggering people, because it does dive down into the body. It does dive down to the heart. We go, we turn inside, and that can be a very scary place, right? So I had a friend who's a retired psychologist, and I said, Ed, I had this opportunity to teach these poetry workshops, and I'm really excited, and I'm also, like, worried in a way, or scared a little bit. And he kind of chuckled, and he said, Jim, just present your material, let people tell their story, and get out of the way. And I think that was some of the best advice I ever got. And Dave Wilner, this gentleman, in his 90s, wrote five chapbooks of poetry.
Wow.
Right. And he used to read at his local library, and he was like an icon. He passed this last year at 99. But I can honestly say, I tell Dave, he changed my life, because after that, this world of healing poetry opened up. I got involved with the Institute for Poetic Medicine, which has just been a fantastic thing to be a part of. Wonderful community. So this idea of healing poetry, to continue answering the question, is the idea of being non-judgmental, of poetry, of being something from the source of our being, or from deep in our heart or our soul, where we don't have to judge or criticize or edit or any of those things. We have different situations where people are open to that, but it's more about just expression. I kind of love what you said about, we're going to dive in to our interview and see where it goes. There's an idea of poetry. If you know at the at the top of the page what you're going to say at the bottom, you're doing it all wrong.
Yes.
Because we, in our inside, know exactly. Our body knows what it wants to say. Our subconscious knows in ways it wants to say things that this thing just gets in the way of. You know, this thinking thing that rests on our shoulders and is critical and judgmental and differentiates us from others in the world. It's an opportunity to be a part of everything that is this world we live in.
Yeah. In these spaces, it sounds like you invite anyone, like anyone's welcome to write a poem or join these workshops. And so I imagine you have people come up to you and be like, oh, I'm not a writer, I'm not a poet.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
My favorite standard answer to that is, a poet named William Stafford once said, in his late 70s, a highly accomplished poet professor was asked, when did you become a poet? And Stafford replied, that's not the right question. The right question is, when do you stop being a poet? Because we're all born poets, and somewhere along the way, we're told we can't be those things anymore. So it's really just it's a conversation with that essential part of ourself that we've kind of grown out of or built walls around, or you know, it's something we all can do.
Yeah, and when you and I had spoken on the phone like a week ago, you had said something to me like, we all have a soul that yearns to express itself, no matter who we are. And I was just like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. I have to write that down. Well, you know, and I read once, like, I'm not trying to tell you what to say or how to say it or what to do. I'm simply asking you to listen to what your soul is trying to tell you. And doesn't our soul try to tell us things in our dreams, in our those moments we're driving, we kind of drift away, and we're not caught up in our stuff and our being and doing. It's that respite. So John Fox is the founder and director of the Institute for Poetic Medicine, and I had a conversation with him because he got involved with DAISY. The Institute for Poetic Medicine actually funded a seed grant in 2016, 2017 to put on these poetry workshops, these healing poetry workshops. So I got to work with John. And after several months, we were having a conversation. I said, John, it's just amazing what can happen when people have an opportunity to simply just express themselves, to speak, and also to simply to sit and listen. And John said, yeah, and there's a third element to that, Jim. And I said, what's that? He said, integration. And I said, what's your definition of that? And he said, well, that it's okay to come home to ourselves. And so much of this stuff of healing poetry or these experiences, our relationships, in the case of DAISY, working with folks who have experienced some of the most god-awful forms of trauma, that we can still be human beings. And we can still have that sense of beauty and wonder and joy that is essential to our healing, right? And it's not an academic exercise. It's like presenting material, letting people tell their story, and getting out of the way.
Yeah, right before I had hit record, you and I were having a conversation about, you used the words like levels of healing. I was talking about how I've been struggling with long COVID for months and just not really finding answers and having times where it's very debilitating. And yet I was eager for this conversation today, even though I didn't feel great this morning, because it's like, well, it's going to bring me joy. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to tap in for myself into these moments that lift my spirit and bring me into community, because I think that's part of healing. And so I place poetry in that. And I'm curious how you've seen that play out. Like, when you talk about the levels of healing and you think about poetry in that context.
I loved our conversation too, in terms of levels of healing in your situation. I can speak to my own and, you know, others struggling with that. And you use the phrase social prescribing. And I thought, the first thing I thought, my God, we've done that for generations. You know, we've had communities where we were seen and we were part of the community, and we didn't have to be anything other than who we were and appreciated for what we are in the community, right? And this is generational. And so we all danced and we all sang and we all had storytelling and we talked about our dreams or, you know, what our day was, and it was heard on many different levels. So I think that capacity to be seen and heard on a level that isn't found typically in our society. We've taken art and made it into America's Got Talent. And if you don't win the prize, then you're just like I've told people I'm a poet, they say, oh, are you published? Yeah. And I have an anecdote of a person from a DAISY who ran away from home at 14, wound up in Florida, got her GED, became a nurse. She's in her 60s now, and you know, this person in our writing workshops would just write a line or two and immediately discredit herself. Well, I'm not as good as, or I can't write like you guys. And I know I can't, and you guys know it too. But she'd write, and she started filling up pages, and I'd photocopy her when she her writing. And I found in the margins, like a year later, what she'd written, just kind of a couple sentences, but it goes like this. Dear inner critic, I feel you less now, such as in writing this down. I'm not afraid anymore to be creative. I love this unveiling of this lost part of me. Melody P. McCarthy. So I found this like a year later, and the next workshop, I included that as one of the poems, and I didn't put her name in. And we read it. And, oh, that's cool. And I said, hey, Melody, hey, do you like that? What do you think of that? That's pretty great. I said, do you know who wrote that? I said, you did. And like, we're all like bursting out laughing at that point. But that's like that gift we have. And sometimes we're so intent on saying we don't have it, we don't recognize it.
Oh, I just want to pause on that for a moment. How she said, I'm not afraid anymore. And she used that phrase unveiling, like this allowing herself to be seen again. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to get into, you've described to me a little bit of how you open every workshop. And I remember when you were telling me, we were talking on the phone, you're like, oh, do you want me to describe how I open the workshop? And I just, sure, you know, I'll learn about that. But I found it so beautiful that I'm going to ask, can you describe how you begin your workshops?
Yes, I will. Gladly. I'll usually start with a quote or a line from a poem, just to read that, kind of wade in, put our toes in the shallow end of the pool. And then we'll, like, the one I used yesterday was from Robert Bly, Growing Wings, which I think he wrote in his late 70s. The last two lines of the poem, he addresses himself. Robert, you've climbed so many trees to reach the nest. It's all right if you grow your wings on the way down. So then I do something called 10 good breaths, where I read once we breathe 20,300 breaths a day. So, you know, why not take 10 nice slow ones? So we do that, shut our eyes, and just very simple, right? And I think that pause is really important in terms of just kind of letting go of the day. And just go over a couple of responsibilities. And for new folks, I announce I have 10 non-negotiable rules for writing poetry. Rule number one, no apologies for anything you write, because we're really good at listening to this thing and saying, I can't, I never have, I don't like poetry, what am I doing here? And we compare ourselves, that whole thing. So we don't have to apologize. Rule number two, have fun, exclamation point. And then I announce, I forgot the other 8 rules, so we'll just go with those two. And there's almost like a palpable sense of relief of we don't have to judge ourselves or grade, we can have some fun. I'm considering writing rule number 3 in case of emergency, forget all the rules and just write. That's on the list, but we'll see. But as I mentioned in our conversation, when I started at Daisy 8 years ago, I struggled with, like, because I goofed around with those rules for years. To me, because me, it is fun. And I thought, Jim, who are you to say that to folks who've gone through what these individuals have experienced? But I did it. And I found, you know, I guess I would, this thing on my head was doing too much judging, that we want to be seen as more than our story or the worst things that have happened to us. We are more than those. And what I have found too, in terms of healing poetry groups, working with GED classes, working with individuals with behavioral health issues, working with men who have used violence, is that those experiences have a potential for self-expression that's often missed. There's a sense of resolve or resiliency that comes, I think, from being, you know, labeled or marginalized in some sense, or re-victimized by what our social prescribing has done for certain individuals, right? So I have the 10 non-negotiable rules for writing poetry. I just tell folks to write the way they speak. Don't worry about punctuation or spelling or word choice. Don't worry about worrying because the pay isn't any better. Listen for the music in your words. You know, there's a real beauty in rhythm and cadence and tone that has something to offer us that trying to think of a particular word might not give us, just the kind of flow of our voice and a cadence or another person's flow. One of my favorites is refuse to follow directions. Making sense is not a priority. And most importantly of all, treat ourselves with kindness in this process. That the sense of kindness is foundational, I think, to soul work, which is really what this is. I think with poetry and conversations and reading poems, and you know, to think that somebody may have put weeks or months into something we're reading in this condensed form and the beauty of those things. It could be the simplest thing, which connects us to a bird or a tree or a memory or a grandparent or a cat. That it's has a profound sense of exploration and arrival. Right? We go to a different shore sometimes. So then I use, I'll have maybe 10 quotes that I ask individuals to read out loud. And the fun thing about that is that I like is that each person has an opportunity to read something profound and hear their own voice in the room and kind of let that sink into their body. And we have a discussion about that. Did you see a line you liked? You know, one of the lines I like is from Odysseus Laertes, a Greek poem. Poetry is a bird that ignores all frontiers. Or one is, Mommy, I'm not kidding, and I'm not joking, and I'm not fooling around. I want chocolate, from Sophia, from Sophia, age 3. I mean, these things we can identify as happiness is a warm puppy. Just anything that Yogi Berra said, hit, how the hell can you hit and think at the same time? I mean, that's what poetry is. We don't have to think. Poetry emerges, or it reveals ourselves, and we have to go meet it, kind of thing. And then we recite some affirmations from John Fox's wonderful book, Poetic Medicine. I am creative. I value the healing power of language. I write from my gut and heart. I trust humor and sensitivity. I give voice to the wild and joyous parts of myself. I give voice to the stormy and grieving parts of myself. I am compassionate toward myself. I make a place for the mystery and the creative in my life. I am safe writing on the page. I make my home a place to write. And I'll ask folks which line they caught their eye. And in 10 years or so of using that, I'd say the one that folks have pointed out most is I am compassionate toward myself. That one I struggle with. There's no healing without compassion. In a group like Daisy or a Bridgeway where I work once a week with my co-facilitator Nina, folks who have been through these shared experiences pick up on the nuances of their poems, like, oh yeah, I know what that is, and we see each other. I think the best laugh we've had in a long time with a fellow and Richard the other day in Bridgeway, we're going to write an ode. And he wrote an ode to benzodiazepine. And everybody was howling, like, this related to it. So I think it's that social prescription on a level that can be at once childlike, in the sense of wonder and mystery, and also generational, ancestral, in terms of, you know, we've inherited stories in our bodies and we don't often know how to put them into words, but when we gather and share those words, there's something timeless in that.
So much of what you said there, I just was jotting down different words that you said, that poetry emerges, that it's soul work, that when you give people the chance to read quotes at the beginning, that they have the chance to hear their own voices in the room, and their voices saying something profound or funny or beautiful. But what I love most is that you said, we, like when we gather and we share our stories or we share our words, that we see each other. And there's, I think we have all this profound need to belong and be seen and to see. And I'm just wondering, like, for you, what that feels like in the room. I know for a while I was doing this sort of work and I was working more intimately and leading poetry workshops, and it was beautiful. And then I was ready for different work. I left that and I started doing something else. And my soul felt like lost for the 5 months or so that I wasn't doing it, until I was invited back to do a poetry workshop. And in that moment that I did it, and it wasn't with poets, it was, you know, with the Parkinson's community that I had been working with. Mm-hmm. And I remember just feeling so present, like I hadn't in 5 months, surrounded by community sharing words, that I hoped I was bringing something to the group, but something for me on a personal level, like you said, blew me open. And I felt like, I don't know, how would you describe the moments of being in these rooms?
That is a great question. So we read these poems, right? And sometimes I'll get some stuff that's kind of absurd, or like, what was that? Or, because my God, there's so many fantastic, beautiful poems. I love the moments of silence where folks are writing and you can see the level of intention, and they're filling up half a page or a page, and it goes where it goes. I guess, you know, I've used this quote from Jod Madden, who was a football coach, and they Madden those video games. He's like, that's his name. But he said before the team went out in the field for every game, he said, don't worry about the horse being blind. Let's load up the wagon and head on into town. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I have no idea what that means, but I think it's kind of like that. Like, I don't know. It's like, I don't know what the top of the page, what it's, the poem's going to be at the bottom. And that's what this is, but it's 3, 4, 8, 10, 12, you know, 15 people. And here we are. And somebody can just say a couple sentences or a couple lines, and it's like, oh my God, I love that. So for me, it's joy, wonder, fun, community, patience. It's another kind of beauty. It's like looking out the window and seeing the world, like, oh, look at this.
Yeah, it absolutely is a form of beauty. And I'm probably going to butcher this, but I was listening to a podcast recently, and there was a scientist who was studying awe. Mm. And he was saying that you think of awe and you might think we feel awe in ourselves when you see like a, you know, like a wonder of the world or some like amazing architecture, or even something grand in nature. But he said the number one space where we feel awe is with each other, just like in things of like watching someone move through their day or navigate something hard, or like it's in each other. And so I feel like there's something there, the beauty that happens, poetry's there, and there's something sacred about it, but it's also like connecting on that intimate level that strikes that beauty, as you said, or awe, as I'm saying.
Yeah. I think so much of this is unlearning all the things we were taught along the way, who we are and aren't. And it is that beauty, the connection. I remember Joseph Campbell talking about like witnessing a gorgeous sunset, and it's like, it kind of takes your breath away. It's that's the connection with the divine, right? Robert Bly said something effect of whatever you write at some point in your poem, you know, pay homage to the divine or recognize the divine. And I think for me, that the process in itself is a connection with whatever that awe is. I don't have words for it, that which shall not be named. The expression of being co-creators with God, that this is kind of blossoming in beauty and color, that we can offer ourselves and offer each other. And a lot of that is, you know, Brene Brown, the vulnerability piece of being seen, open up. You know, if we're doing a healing poetry workshop with survivors and they're opening up to their pain or their the experience that they had or the life they had to leave after that, there's a profound sense of connection of, I guess, almost like a resolve of seeing things through and not submitting to the narrative that's been created by others. So there's that sense of a life affirmation, I guess I'll say, of affirming myself and my voice as being unique. I like that word, awe.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I guess that feels like a good segue for me of like life affirming and not submitting to a narrative. So I want to read you an excerpt from a poem by Maryam, who was 15 when she wrote it and growing up in Afghanistan. And she said, "So tell me that I can't, so I can show you that I really can. And never, ever underestimate the power of a girl and her voice. I will be more than you said I could be." So Maryam was going to school at SOLA when she wrote that. So tell me, what is SOLA and how did you get involved with it?
Yeah, SOLA is School of Leadership Afghanistan. And I think it started in like 2011, was the only girls boarding school in Afghanistan. I got involved with SOLA after having attended a conference in Maine called the Great Mother Conference, which is a mytho-poetic journey. And it's held at a camp in a beautiful setting, a big lake. And so we have these really nice cabins. And in 2012, I was with a couple Afghan students and their sponsor, a woman named Julianne Reed. Next year, I was in another cabin. Julianne and another girl named Fatima were there. And I was so taken by this 17, 18-year-old girl who was so incredibly passionate about learning and direct in her conversations and curious and so much fun. And Julianne and I are talking. It's like, how did you get involved? She says, well, I do an online kind of mentor thing. It's like, okay, how do I do that? So I did. And started in 2013. And I love to tell the story. The first student I worked with was 13, named Frozan. So it's supposed to be conversational English and ESL, have an ESL certification. And so, of course, after our first meeting, I said, hey, Frozan, find a poem in Dari, in the native language, and translate it into English, and we'll discuss it next week. So she shared a poem about a father and a son going to see a mosque for the first time. And we get halfway through this poem and it describes God as this man with a mitre and vestments and all this stuff. And we get halfway through the poem and Frozen says, Mr. Jim, does God have to be a man? Mm. And I thought, well, this is the country where terrible things happen for women who express any kind of individuality. I said, what would your parents say about that question? She said, oh, they'd laugh, but my grandmother wouldn't laugh. Okay. I said, what would your school say, SOLA? And she said, my school teaches me to think for myself. Mm. So we made God a woman in the poem. So we had workshops there from 2013, once a week, to 2019. And 2019 COVID hit. And so we haven't been back together other than just catching up sometimes with some of the students who are expatriates. But if you or your listeners go to 60 Minutes, there was a piece on SOLA from February 26th. It's just an amazing, amazing story of that school and the perseverance and determination and courage of the founder, Shabana, and all those kids. It's really a testament to the human spirit, what's really humbling and just a joy to be a part of. So I've been in touch with Solar there in Rwanda now, and yeah, joyfully we're going to start the workshops again.
Oh,
really excited. Yeah, that poem by Miriam just kind of says it all, right? I will be more than you said I could be.
Mm.
And there's a fierce grace, to use Ram Dass's expression, that these kids embody.
Yeah, can you describe the girls, or, and I'm sure it's different, but a little bit of the circumstances of their lives, or?
You know, like in speaking with Miriam and the pressure that she felt and her family felt from other relatives, like, why are you sending your girl to school? Mm-hmm. Don't you know that's wrong? That, you know, I remember I had a conversation with her a year or so ago where she said, like, the vast majority of people on some levels agree with the Taliban. So here are these young women who have this incredible thirst for learning are being oppressed by this incredibly cruel system of the patriarchy in the extreme. You know, we all live in a part of that. And they have their challenges, right? The students who are in the States now really have some challenges that, you know, I, as a cisgendered white male, can offer what I can offer, but I know it goes beyond on some levels what I can't offer. So hopefully through poetry, through expression, and they can find their own words for that kind of thing, because they do it beautifully. Poetry has been an integral part of their culture. I mean, you hear students say, we have family gatherings and I'll have recitations of poetry, and one will follow the next, and they'll play games where you have to, you know, top the poem. It's almost like a spoken word event, but it's so generational. These poems are going back centuries. There's a spoken word poetry tradition of called the Lande, and for Afghan women, that's been around for 600 years. It's like, I think, I can't remember the syllabic content of it, but it's a couple lines. It's anonymous. It's shared among women and not men, and for good reason, right? But that tradition is a part of the women's culture there. I think these girls embody too. There's a ferociousness there, because a lot of us suffer jokes, I think, about their husbands and that sort of, and the ineptitude of men. I won't go into it. But I remember one of the land days that I appreciated, which was recently published, and the person's name is escaping me. I could give you that later. But the poem goes, you sold me to an old man, father. May God destroy your home. I was your daughter. So, yeah, their situation is complex, and they, you know, a lot of these kids had to leave without saying goodbye to the parents. They went through 3 days of Kabul airport with the chaos. And
you're talking about once the Taliban was taking
over. Right. Yeah. But I mean, if you tune into that or see that 60-minute clip to see these kids thriving in their own way in Rwanda, it's just it's an inspiration and good work that I can't say enough about how great it is to see it continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would second that. I'll put the link in the show notes so that people can find the 60 minutes. Feature on it, and it does go into what happens after the Taliban has banned school for girls, education for girls, and where SOLA has ended up now. And I think you told me that SOLA means peace. Is that true?
Yes, and Pashtun means peace. And you'll see one of the girls, Adine, and her sister, Saji, who are both in the poetry workshops. And they speak at length about their experiences. But I had this book from the SOLA students over several years. And the introduction, or part of the introduction, was written by Adine. And I'll just read that. Since I can remember, poetry has been part of me, part of my soul, and part of my life. Many times I've realized how much I need to talk to someone and express my feelings and reveal the hard time I have inside myself. But usually, I don't find anyone better than my pen and paper with writing an idea of me on it.
Mm. And what's the name of that book so people can find that?
Part of Me, Part of My Soul. So that would have to come through me or John Fox, because it's not on Amazon or anything. But who knows, maybe someday it will be. Just some beautiful poems in there by these girls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I am the father of two girls. And somebody asked me once, so what's it like, you know, working with these students? I said, it's just being a dad. You know, that's all. Being a dad on a Zoom call. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you may have to come back once you restart those Zoom workshops and tell us more. But for the moment, I wanna finish up with a little bit of a game where I'm gonna say the start of a sentence, and I want you to finish the sentence.
Oh my God, I feel like I'm one of my classes now.
Cool. No judgment. You can pass on any of them.
I love this because, one of the things I do say in my thoughts on writing poetry, T.S. Eliot said, amateurs borrow, masters steal.
Mm.
So one of the things I instruct participants is find what you love and steal it.
Yeah.
Absolutely steal it. And in the process, make it your own.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody might be talking about experience in, you know, the Bronx or LA or something, and now I'm going to write about, you know, Blairstown, New Jersey, where I grew up, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
But the feeling is there. If we capture the feeling, then we can. So when you said finish the line, so good. Yeah, I'm going to steal this. So.
Oh, I'm trying to steal things from your workshop already.
Yes.
Mine.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
So now I'm glad we're on the same page. I'm allowed to steal those things. Yeah. And vice versa. So the first sentence for you is, writing in community is.
Writing in community to me is an opportunity to walk out into the world and at once walk in toward myself.
Mm. Oh, yes. The line of poetry I keep coming back to lately is.
Oh. I learn by going where I have to go.
Mm. Mm.
From The Waking by Theodore Recchi, which is like one of those first poems I read in college and is so fascinatingly obscure and beautiful and gorgeous that I keep. It's like my favorite poem. God bless the ground, I shall walk softly there.
Yeah.
And learn by going where I have to go.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The next one for you is, the poem I really want to write in this moment is about.
My heart, my soul, my girlfriend, Lori.
And the last one I have for you is, right now I'm grateful for
the opportunity to breathe.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, Jim, this has been an absolute blessing for me.
Oh.
And it has, like I said, a time when I personally needed like my spirit to be buoyed. You provided that. And I hope everyone listening feels that too. I feel like I've gotten to walk back home through this conversation and everything that you've shared. So thank you.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you, Ashley, for this opportunity.
I need to know everything, who and the what and the where, I need everything. Trust me, I hear what you're saying, but I like it's new what you're telling me. I'm curious, George, I hop in the Porsche, it's five and a horse, I'm ready for war, I'm coming for throats, to turn to a ghost, I need to know everything. Now you'll be surprised at the info you get is by letting them talk, so I'm letting them talk. Gotta keep quiet, maneuver in silence, then let them in, talk up their body, another one body, that's just how it go. I got some secrets, I'm shaking the game so they stay on their toes. Stay in your lane, how to stay on the go. I came to play with the pros and act like a rookie, so they overlook me. Then I double up again under their nose, none of them cold. They just got lucky but never adapted, so I'm to the one if it's coming to blows. My enemies cutting it close, I let them think that they got me, but what do you know? I had them beat before we ever spoke, I'm ready for smoke. I need to know everything, who and the what and the where, I need everything. Trust me, I hear what you're saying, but I like it's new what you're telling me. I'm curious, George, I hop in the Porsche, five and a horse, I'm ready for war, I'm coming for throws, to turn to a ghost, I need to know everything.